You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
Global warming might be on your mind after the record high temperatures this summer. It may even prompt you to leave your car at home from time to time when you go to pick up the groceries. But after you've made the decision to walk to the store, that's the best you can do, right? Well, apparently not. According to a study by two geophysicists at Chicago University, you can have just as big an effect on global warming by what you put in your shopping cart once you get there. Gideon Eschel and Pamela Martin published a report earlier this year on how our dietary choices affect climate change. Gideon Eschel joins us this morning from Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. What made you decide to investigate the link between diet and global warming?
Mostly the realization that governments, at least in the States, pretty much irrespective of their party, don't really take global warming seriously and seem to exhibit complete impotence in their approach to global warming, which leaves any putative solutions in the hands of private citizens. And there's nothing really, there isn't really one major thing that we can do to limit our greenhouse gas emissions. It's rather a long list of small effects, and diet is one of those.
What kind of diets did you decide to study?
We basically covered the entire range from the typical mean American diet, which nicely abbreviates to MAD, is sort of the mainstay of the study. But we also studied the two end members. One is a completely plant-based diet with no animal products in it, and as well as other diets that are fairly extreme in their reliance on animal products. So the whole spectrum.
And in the study, you used personal transportation as a kind of baseline. How did you do this?
Right, so it's like a yardstick. To, you know, when you say to a person, okay, this affects you to the tune of X tons of CO2 a year, it doesn't really ring familiar to most people. So we chose driving habits as a good yardstick. And so it's pretty easy, actually. You take the, for the States, there's a very good record kept of, the average number of miles your average American is driving, and the average gas efficiency he or she gets, et cetera. And so from that, we didn't actually come up with a single number, but with a whole suite of possibilities spanning anywhere from, a person who commutes a long distance every day with a very large car, like an SUV or a Hummer, all the way to a person who drives very infrequently and drives a Prius, and anything in between.
And so if you are on a meat-based diet, how does this compare with someone who's on a plant-based diet?
Yeah, that's the key finding, right? So we basically concluded that the difference between your the greenhouse gas emissions of eating of a purely plant-based diet to eating the typical average American diet, that difference is a ton and a half of CO2 a year. Emitted or that such people are responsible for. So, for example, if you're eat purely plant-based diet, you emit a certain amount. If you eat the mean American diet, you emit that amount plus a ton and a half of CO2. And when I say emit, I don't really mean physically you emit, but that you are responsible for the emissions of.
And so what if you're not eating red meat, but you're eating fish or you're eating poultry?
Poultry is better, somewhat better. fish is actually very span a very broad range. Some fish are very, very good for from the standpoint of planetary consequences. Others are really bad. And it basically has to do with where the what species you're eating, where the species is on the grand scheme of the ocean food web, and how far you have to travel to catch it. So, for example, anchovy or sardines are extremely an extremely good choice. They are extremely ubiquitous along coastlines. And it only takes a very short trip to, and you catch them by the netful, as opposed to say tuna or shark or sword that are at the very top of the food chain, the oceanic food web, which means that you need to travel great distances to catch them, and a catch is fairly infrequent. You know, I think anybody who read The Perfect Storm, this wonderful book by Sebastian Junger, appreciates how hard it is to catch a swordfish, and that is also reflected in the amount of CO2 that is associated with catching that swordfish.
And so, as you said, it's not the food consumers that are producing the emission, but the energy that's used by producing the food. Can you explain how energy is used in food production?
Yeah, it's actually not only energy. It's a really important point. I mean, you're absolutely right that energy is an important parameter. It's about roughly half, depending on your diet. And that simply means you need some energy to produce the food that you eat, and that energy is generated in some power plant, and that power plant emits greenhouse gases. That's fine. Now, the other half or so is indirect, and it's associated with other greenhouse gases. We chose to consider only two that are the two main ones after CO2, and those are nitrous oxide and methane. And they are mostly emitted either directly from ruminants as a byproduct of ruminant digestion, or they are associated with manure treatment and everything that happens after the food is produced, essentially, or during, but unrelated to it, that is mostly related to manure treatment, etc. And there's another big chunk that we left out completely because it was very complicated to do, and that is land use changes.
And so, when you're looking at, I guess, the two sides of it, the energy in actually producing the food and then the other effects, is it worse for meat in both cases versus producing the same amount of vegetables?
Yeah, with very few exceptions. For example, actually, surprisingly, spinach or mesclun, I don't know if that's how you guys pronounce it in Canada, but you know what I mean, like the really fine salad greens, those are actually energetically very inefficient, and They produce no nitrous oxide and no methane, but they do consume a lot of energy, which means that they also are responsible for the emissions of a lot of CO2. But mostly, plants are plant-based foods have an energetic efficiency of about 2 to 5, which means that for every energy unit that you put in, you harvest about 2 units. As opposed to animal foods, animal-based foods, which are about a tenth, which means that you get out only one tenth of what you put in.
So, is it your recommendation that people should all move towards becoming vegans or vegetarians?
No, you know, I'm just a scientist, right? I don't make recommendations, but It would be nice. I mean, I try to eat as few animal products as possible, and really the only time I eat any animal products is when I'm on the road, and at least in the U.S., there's very limited options. You don't have to go all the way, you know. I mean, you can just kind of, every time you are approaching a meal, you can put that into the whole suite of considerations you apply to choosing your meal. I mean, you know, we choose our food based on many different considerations, same way we choose what to drive, say, or where to drive and how much, etc. So it's just another thing to think about, another element of our effect on the planet.
Your next research project is also related to agriculture. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, right. So Pam and I do a lot of different things, but the one that's most ready for prime time that we're going to report in December in the American Geophysical Union gathering in San Francisco is about the global warming consequences of corn subsidies, which I gather is an important issue also in Canada. Basically, the line of reasoning is that the U.S. at least spends pretty substantial sums of money supporting agriculture. I don't know, actually, if supporting is the right word. Doling out, maybe, is a better word. Huge sums of money to farmers to grow or not to grow corn, for example. We are mostly interested in corn. And that has two major effects. One is it produces, you know, colossal amounts of unnecessary and unwanted, really, corn that nobody really knows what to do with. So the food manufacturers, in their infinite ingenuity and wisdom, come up with various ways to blow all this corn, you know, that's out there. And so this is how people get extremely cheap soda, for example, because it's corn-based pretty much exclusively, and also very relatively affordable meat. You know, so you think, well, there's nothing really inherently wrong with meat. It's just that if you eat it two meals a day, every day, then it adds up. So you ask, well, why do people do that? Why do they eat so much meat? Partly the answer is because it is kept artificially cheap by corn subsidies. That's the line of reasoning.
Great. Well, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Gideon Eschel. He's an assistant professor in the geophysics department at the University of Chicago and co-author with Pamela Martin of a study on diet, energy consumption, and global warming.